Today is Tuesday, June 16, 2020. This is part 8 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Charles Butch Farabee, spelled F-A-R-A-B-E-E. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Butch. How are you today?
Good, thanks.
Good. Thank you so much for your continued participation in this Grand Canyon oral history series. May we have your permission to record this interview over the phone?
Yes, you may.
Thank you very much. Last time we were talking about some of the really horrific incidences that happened to you during your 10 years at Yosemite. And you started to mention the Park Medic program. Could you tell me more about that, please?
Well, okay. The Park Medic program, I'm not sure if it's spelled as one big word or if it's two separate words. I think I've seen it both ways. But in about 1976, January 24, 1976, I was looking it up as you were talking it. There was a cave rescue in Sequoia National Park in Soldier's Cave, which actually I have been in. And it's like most caves, you know, it's got all its twists and vertical things and what have you. And a guy was in there caving and broke his back.
Oh.
Or at least broke a femur. I mean, it was a serious incident anyway. So, you know, they're quite a ways in. And the Rangers, although they were EMTs, which isn't that much more advanced than advanced first aid, that doesn't qualify you for a lot of things. They were faced with trying to get this guy out of there. And this was before the National Cave Rescue Commission had come to be, that sort of thing. Or it was about the same time, actually. And so they had to go in, and Dr. Jakes, J-A-K-E-S, was their medical advisor. And, you know, either they had to bring this guy out or leave him in there for 3 months while he recuperated.
All right.
That's not very viable. So they ended up, they got a nurse who was, a caver or at least an outdoors person. And John Chu, C-H-E-W, was real big into the EMS, early EMS programs that were just starting to evolve, not only in the Park Service, but nationwide. And Paul Fodor, F-O-D-O-R, who was a ranger there, and a number of other rangers. So they went in, and they took this nurse in with them, and they were able to, get the guy put on in a stretcher and immobilized him in the proper manner and able to give him some painkillers and that sort of thing. Anyway, they ended up getting him out of there, and it took quite a while. We're not talking an hour. We're talking, you know, probably 24 to 40 hours in order to get him out of there. And it was successful. Everything was fine. They eventually got him to the hospital. I assume that his recovery was just fine. But at the same time, I, along with other rangers in Yosemite, were starting to face these big wall rescues and some really pretty interesting challenging, complicated kinds of rescues where there were people injured but in weird places and in difficult places to access. And at the time, all we had were EMTs. I think I mentioned the other day that I was in that first class at Camp Lejeune, 1973. And other rangers had been going to EMT classes at that time, and Dr. Wargler was starting to teach EMT in Yosemite. But the truth is, you know, we had some advanced training, but it was really pretty minimal by today's standards, for sure. But because of the nature of Yosemite and Sequoia, because of their jurisdictions, which are basically exclusive. Now, technically, that's not the correct term, but for all intrinsic purposes, exclusive jurisdiction, which meant that we, the Park Service, did not have to necessarily abide by state laws and standards. So we actually had some latitude when it came to certain things like the EMS, Emergency Medical Systems, protocols and policies that existed in the state of California. And Dr. Wergler was the Rangers medical supervisor in Yosemite, and is actually a Dr. Webster, W-E-B-S-T-R, who was, I think he's like the head of the emergency operations for Valley Medical Center in Fresno. He was the medical oversight for the Rangers in Sequoia and Kings Canyon. So this rescue takes place in Sequoia. We're on a, you know, sort of a daily basis faced with our own issues. And John Chu, who's also, as I said, big into EMS, but also was somewhat responsible for the training, overall training for Rangers in Sequoia, and I was overall responsible for training of Rangers in Yosemite, we got together, and he approached me and said, you know, we ought to think about some sort of advanced training besides EMT. And I don't know exactly who mulled over what, but soon, though, he and I were meeting in Fresno, and we met with this Dr. Webster at Valley Medical Center, and we pitched the concept of something beyond EMT, which over time has evolved into the Park Medic program. But because of the jurisdictions, he and Dr. Wergler, this Dr. Webster and Dr. Wergler, both knew that we could do certain things that people on the outside, you know, within just the state of California, would not be permitted to do.
Okay.
Does that make sense so far?
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, as this concept is pitched, we mull it around, and Dr. Webster starts adding his 2 cents worth, and we end up, John and I, going down there a number of occasions, probably on my own time. We would meet, probably have lunch, and then talk to Dr. Webster and one or two of his co-workers, and they decided that they could put together, and that we explored with them. In fact, I remember giving them a slide program on some of the things we were doing in Yosemite.
Okay.
On just some of the, you know, the complications with the big walls and the cliffs and stuff. So they put together a curriculum with emergency room operations, pharmacy, some emergency room training, I mean experience, you know, hands-on stuff. And we came up with what amounted to was 115-hour program, and John came up with the idea of calling it Park Medic as sort of a play on words for paramedic, which wasn't all that old to begin with. Paramedics didn't really come about until the late 1960s. So it was a play on words, but everybody seemed to get really enthusiastic, coupled with the jurisdictional, you know, the ability to do certain things.
Hey,
that
Butch.
Others could do.
And I would assume that there were other national parks throughout the country that had their own jurisdictional abilities as well outside of California.
Well, yes, but yeah, I mean, there are other parks that have either partial legislative or exclusive kinds of jurisdictions, but they didn't necessarily have the isolation factor that we might have.
Oh, I see. That's right. Okay.
And sometimes the complexity of missions. I mean, Rocky Mountain for sure.
Yellowstone, Grand Canyon.
They have certainly major operations.
Right.
not with the regularity that we had in Yosemite, but, you know, they certainly are complicated and hard when you've got these big cliffs in both of those parks.
Right.
But a place like Yellowstone, you've got a clinic within the park, and the only real bad thing about Yellowstone would be, you know, hard to get to another city with a hospital. But in the wintertime, that might be a concern as well. But at this point, it was, well, I guess that was a long answer to your question, Tom. Yes, there are other parks out there that have got these kinds of concerns. In this case, you know, John and I are only worried about our two little parks.
Okay. Well, I guess my question is, and it's a long way to get to it, at this time, as you're talking to Dr. Webster and Dr. Wergler, were you thinking this could have benefit outside of California to the National Park Service, or were you just thinking about Sequoia, Kings Canyon, Yosemite, and that's it?
That's it.
Okay, thank you.
You know, in some ways we thought beyond our nose, but in other ways we did not. And, you know, our concern was really just taking care of our own in-house problems. And of course, we're certainly glad that it expanded, but at the time it was just what we were doing.
Yeah, okay.
So John, I had a much bigger ranger staff in the park in Yosemite than John did in Sequoia and Kings. But finally, when Dr. Webster and we sort of had to say, okay, this is what we're going to do, and we had to obligate some manpower and set some dates and start shooting for, you know, beginning. John said, I can commit, you know, something like 6 or 8 rangers. And this is going to be one day a week for, one full week. One full day, rather, each week for probably 10 weeks or more,
right.
12 weeks perhaps. And that does not count emergency room time, weekend time, but sort of just sheer classroom stuff.
Okay. And you would all have to then drive somewhere for that class.
So we were going to Fresno. It was a 2-hour drive for us. For us, it was an all-day thing. We'd go down in the morning, and we would drive home that night.
Wow.
Coming and going would be all on our own time. You know, you might get some compensated time at the end, but you weren't getting paid for it.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, I can get, 12 or 14 rangers. So we had a class. You know, we had, you know, roughly 20, 22 or so rangers to begin with. And we were going to show up on a certain day, which is what we did, and we started our program. Well, about a week before we were to meet there in Fresno with Dr. Webster and his group, I realized that the superintendent of Yosemite did not know anything about this.
Oops.
Yes, oops. And I broke into a cold sweat when this realization actually hit my little brain.
And who was the superintendent at the time?
So Les Arenberger was the superintendent.
So
Arenberger.
So this is Rob Arenberger's father, is that right?
Correct. Yes.
Okay. And Les Arenberger went through Glen Canyon before Glen Canyon Dam in the 1950s.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Long serving Park Service superintendent.
Right. Yeah, and he was a planner by mostly education way back when. And,
okay.
I think he was the National Park Service's first. I can't even remember the right term now. I can visualize it, but anyway, he was a very prominent early manager for the Park Service.
Mm-hmm.
Very nice guy. Didn't necessarily know everything that Protection Rangers did, but I think he mostly appreciated what we did.
Okay.
So I remembered that all of a sudden the big kahuna for Yosemite did not know what was going on. So I wrote him a memo. Now, this has all been published elsewhere. I've actually talked to Les Arnberger about this long before he died. But I wrote him a memo saying, pursuant to my first memo, and then I proceeded to lay out, you know, to refresh his memory on what we were doing, who was going, the benefits, sort of a cost analysis kind of thing. And I sent it to him. And I sent it directly. And the relationships in those days were probably a little more informal than they are today. A lot of it's all based on personality and stuff. So I sent this memo directly to him. And, you know, because I know that I probably could easily have torpedoed this entire effort.
Oh, wow.
With, you know, and Dr. Webster's got, you know, nurses and other doctors and the pharmacist and, you know, people that were our teachers, you know, they're all sort of on hold.
Right.
Of course, none of them know anything about this, that I've screwed this up.
And they were going to be paid for this. Is that right? This was going to be some money involved here.
Well, no.
Really?
No.
Okay.
No. I mean, I can't swear that Dr. Webster wasn't paying overtime to some of his.
Oh, I see. Okay.
But perhaps that was. But mostly, we were trying to accommodate people's schedules and.
Right. So it wasn't any more funding out of anybody's pockets. It was just that this staff would not be available at the service units to do their duties. They'd be off doing something else.
Correct. And that was my concern, is that, you know, the superintendent did not know that 12 or 14 or so of his key protection rangers would not even be in the park one day a week for the next couple of months, which, you know, in the late winter, early spring, maybe that's not such a big deal, but over time that could have been. So I send this memo off to him, and I'm in a big sweat the entire time. And a couple of days later, I get this nice handwritten note on the memo that I sent to him saying, thanks, Butch, for the update. You know, keep up the good work, you know. Good luck to all you guys, or something, you know, pretty innocuous like that. But at least I was no longer on the hook, and the program was no longer on the hook.
No kidding. Wow.
So, anyway, we do our thing, and we are exposed to emergency medical techniques that, you know, in theory, we might have known before, but this is all being pushed even further. We got into a lot of heart rhythm kinds of interpretations, and it was pretty intense. And so that program, then we had another class after that. Everybody, and I mean, you know, the park staffs and ourselves and the park managers and stuff, started seeing the benefit of this advanced training.
Another class, meaning a round of 20 or so more people?
Yeah.
Or?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I don't remember all the specifics to that. Actually, I've not been able to find any kind of a roster that I put together for that first class. You know, I've asked some of my peers over the years. I said, did you go to that first class, you know, and some would say yes, some would say no, but I've been trying to resurrect or reconstruct them, who actually went. So, but anyway, so that really launched a program that is not only nationally recognized by the National Park Service, but it's been adopted by other agencies, including FEMA. It's really become quite a well-recognized program with a need, and it's not that every park in the system has that need. It's not that every ranger goes through this. You know, people who have an interest, people who have a skill that might be required, you know, etc. But since this would have been roughly 1977 or so on. There have been classes, Valley Medical Center now in Fresno, and I'm not sure if that's, they may have changed the name on that a little bit, like, you know, but it's a level one trauma center for the San Joaquin Valley, and
mm-hmm.
quite prominent when it comes to emergency medical assistance. You know, so it may not be that exact name anymore, but that's what it was, Valley Medical Center. And it is currently the home to this Park Medic program.
There's
a doctor there who is identified as the, you know, the key person for that program, and the training goes through him.
Hmm.
Standards have been set. You know, I'm sure that things have been upgraded over time.
Sure.
At least I would hope they have been. And it's taken off. I mean, it's really quite good. And it's, you know, be hard to define how many people have, whose lives have been saved, or at least have been, injuries have been mitigated. But it will be into the thousands, collectively, anyway.
Nice. Butch, I think of the Wilderness First Responder course, which spends a lot of time on assessment, on sort of the general systems of breathing and circulation and temperature control and stabilization of injured tissues, packaging appropriately, and delivering live during extended circumstances, just like this cave rescue you mentioned.
Yeah. Well, no, that's right. And this was actually probably the launching pad for the Wilderness EMS programs. There are several of them out there now. And, you know, I have not stayed contemporary with them.
Sure.
At one time, I was used, you know, to provide instruction and give guest flight programs and that sort of thing down through the years, but I've lost all of that contact. But that's how this entire, and I don't know that I'm giving too much credit to what we did, but close, I guess. I think that what we did there in Yosemite and Sequoia, and John and myself, I think that's, you know, has launched this Wilderness EMS, not mentality, there's a better word than that, concept, you know, around the country.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
So, you know, although I don't think about it very often, I think that I should take pretty much pride in having helped launch this effort over the years.
Nice. Yeah, absolutely.
One thing I might real quickly mention, just so it's sort of on the record, there, prior to what we were doing with this Park Medic program, you may recall there was a TV program called Emergency, and it would have to be, people would have to be old enough at a certain age to remember this.
Right.
But the two firemen in Los Angeles County are tapped to go to a, as an experiment to give outsiders, in this case firemen, the ability to, you know, start IVs and do a lot of things that we all take for granted today, but which didn't exist in those days. And it took a California state legislature to finally get that off the ground. But there's a whole history there, which, of course, I'm not going into, but all of a sudden, the entire country recognized that, hey, you know, we can do certain things. I mean, we as a citizen, we as the tourist, we as the person traveling down a remote road,
mm-hmm.
we might have benefit of some of these emergency medical procedures, but, you know, we need to have agencies, in this case it turns out mostly the fire departments and then independent paramedic programs. So this TV show called Emergency, which was really quite popular, I mean, it went on for a number of years, and it was nationally done, and you know, by today's standards, it probably would be somewhat hokey, but in those days, you know, there was a lot of people that turned into it and said, you know, why can't we do that in our own little county?
Hmm.
And so this emergency was on the horizon. It was about the same time as our the ill-fated TV series called Sierra, which I don't think I mentioned that when we were talking about Yosemite, did I?
No.
But I'll skip that for the time being, but remind me to come back to the TV series 1973 on Sierra.
Okay.
But it was, the actors that were in Sierra, they crossed over and had guest shots by the actors on Emergency, so we got to know those guys. So it was a concept that its time had come.
Hmm.
And today, most places, lots of places have, full paramedics that do a lot of things that when I was a policeman on the Tucson Police Department and, a young ranger, we just never even thought this was possible.
Right.
So,
right.
Butch, may I just remember the name John Chu, CHEW?
Well, that's exactly my next question was, what can you tell me about John Chu? Can you describe him? Where was he from? What did he do?
Well, I don't know where he's from, but I first met him in Sequoia.
Okay.
He was worked a lot in the backcountry.
Was he a backcountry ranger, or what?
Yeah.
What was his position? Do you remember?
Well, he was. I don't even think we had a backcountry ranger in those days.
Okay.
If anybody, Paul Fodor, F-O-D-O-R, would have been the backcountry wilderness ranger.
Okay.
But, again, you sort of did everything that everybody did a little bit of everything. And so John spent a number of years there. He spent time at Lake Mead as a patrol ranger.
Okay. Before he went to Sequoia Kings Canyon?
I'm going to think about this. Yes. No, I'm sorry. No, hold on a second. No, I'm pretty sure he went to Lake Mead after Sequoia.
Okay.
And was, just an area ranger, did the boat patrol and the road patrol and whatever else you do at Lake Mead. He was there. He ended up transferring to Shenandoah National Park. And he then brings the park medic program to Shenandoah, where he finds a medical advisor there at the University of Virginia Medical School, I believe, who was the godfather for EMS for Shenandoah.
Okay.
And, again, a lot of our efforts were personality-driven. Shenandoah's got, access to lots of little towns and the little cities around. So EMS was somewhat close. But because of John's interest and the fact that there was some wilderness with a small W around Shenandoah,
yeah,
this program got off. The doctor at that time at the University of Virginia, if I'm not mistaken, had been a seasonal park ranger.
Okay.
But couldn't get on.
Doesn't Shenandoah have a highway going through it? Yeah. I would assume there would be lots of accidents on that road that would need...
Yeah, that's probably true, too.
Would need help there, so...
Yep.
Okay.
So then John ended up becoming, he was detailed to the Washington office to work on mostly EMS and maybe health and fitness, but still was a ranger in Shenandoah. But because he couldn't get a promotion out of it and was ready to leave Shenandoah, but he could not get a full-time job in Washington, D.C., he ended up leaving and becoming the Department of Treasury's, Department of Transportation's EMS coordinator. So all of the Flight for Life that you see around the country, based in various hospitals, the helicopter evacuations, as well as the MAST program, MAST, that's the acronym, which means the Military Aid of Safety and Transportation, I think, which is all military-driven. There are about six or eight bases, I think mostly in the West, that would provide premature baby transports, highway medical emergency evacuations, kinds of things. So John ended up spending the next, I don't know, 15 or more years at least, working for the Department of Transportation, and ended up writing or helping to write or certainly orchestrating the various standards, OSHA standards, and the standards that control and the policies for these helicopter evacuation programs around the country. And he got to be quite well respected and quite well known because of that. And he ended up retiring. He's back in Annapolis now, living in Annapolis with his wife.
Okay. So. And we take it for granted that, you know, helicopters are flying every hour on the hour out of Flagstaff Medical Center here in Flagstaff.
Yep.
The concept of helicopters for patient transport is fairly commonplace today, but I don't think it was back in the 70s.
No, absolutely not.
Okay.
Miami-Dade in Florida started a program almost parallel to the one of the big hospitals in Denver.
Okay.
And I think, like maybe out of Seattle. I mean, there are only one or two or three, perhaps a couple, three. And they all sort of came up with this idea at the same time, and how much interaction and coordination and talk they did between themselves, I'm not privy to, but it was all at the same time, roughly.
Did Fresno have a helicopter?
Not for us, they didn't.
Okay.
No, we used Lemoore Naval Air Station all the time.
Oh, okay.
But now there was a helicopter out of Modesto, which I think the park uses quite a bit now.
What's the name of the Naval Air Station?
Lemoore, Lemoore. And it's a 45-minute drive south of Fresno, California. And it's in the San Joaquin Valley, and its main job there is to train pilots. That's where they do the Top Gun kinds of stuff.
Okay.
And the helicopter group there, who, while I was working with them, and I can't say enough nice things about these guys. There's an entire book that should be written about their exploits and their, you know, how they assisted everybody. But their primary job was to back up these Navy fighter pilots so that when, you know, if they had a wreck, a crash, then, you know, that they were to respond. But, you know, fortunately, there weren't that many fighter pilots crashing. And in order to maintain their skill level, and, of course, they certainly loved coming up into both Sequoia and Yosemite. And they were all Vietnam-era trained. They were looking for the excitement. You know, they're adrenaline junkies like the rest of us.
Right.
And they, you know, they loved coming up to the park. And you know, I've got 1,000 slides and hundreds of stories about just Lemoore Naval Air Station and how they not only helping us, but just in general helping them.
Can you share one of those or two of those stories with us here?
Well, yeah, I can. I have to think about some that would be of any interest. You know, they crashed a couple of times. Well, okay, so I'll mention one of the crashes.
Okay.
Several times in the park. So I think in 1976, you know, and I keep saying I think, but you're sort of catching me off guard on some of the exact dates.
Absolutely, understood. No worries.
Of course, I have references, I can refer to that. But in this case, we had a climber and his partner, and his partner is named Dale Bard, B-A-R-D. I'm trying to remember the young man that ended up dying. But they've hiked up to the base of El Capitan. I think it got too hot, and they realized they didn't want to go play on the big cliff that day, so they're coming back down, and you know, climbers, in this case, particularly the elite climbers, tend to take things for granted and maybe aren't as cautious as they should be. This one climber, I think is about 19 years old, holds onto a branch, sort of swings out around a cliff in order to, you know, to keep moving. Well, the branch breaks off, and he ends up tumbling down quite a distance, you know, 100 feet or so, not vertically, but sort of bounce, 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 bounce down. His partner goes down there, Dale goes down there, and Dale, when he's able to get down for help, says that, you know, he's still alive. So, you know, that puts everything into higher gear.
Mm-hmm.
And I was the acting search and rescue officer during this period of time for about 2 weeks. And we had just had somebody killed the day before climbing. So this accident takes place, and I'm not responding to this. I'm not part of this operation. But Dan Sholley, Sholly, gets in the park helicopter, and they fly over, and they look, and they see the sky down below, but they can't really tell for sure what's going on, but they can't find a place to land either, so they come back down, land in the valley, and so now there's a team of about six or eight rangers with stretchers and ropes and whatever EMS equipment we had at the time. They're on their way up, and but at the same time, we've alerted the Navy at Lemoore, made a direct call to them, and said, this is what we've got going. We think he's still alive. And they pretty much said, you know, we're on our way. But we still had to get it cleared through their command, which in this case would have been the Air Force Rescue Coordination Center, which in those days was in St. Louis, Missouri.
Wow.
Or St. Louis, Kansas, actually, I guess. And they were on their way. And because of the relationship, first name basis, we could tell voices, and we would train with them, and they'd come up into the park and train with us. And, you know, it was a really pretty casual relationship in that way, pretty informal. But everybody respected each other. So they're on their way, even though they may not have total official clearance. They knew that they'll get the, you know, clearance on their way up.
Right.
So they get up there, and they end up, you know, they put one of the rangers on board, Paul Henry. They go in, see, you know, by this time, rangers have gotten on scene. Well, the rangers at the time on scene recognize that this guy is now dead.
Okay.
And the normal protocol is that the Navy will not respond to a deceased person because there is no emergency, quote unquote, remaining at this spot.
Okay.
So they were appraised of this. They knew that, you know, we know that this climber is dead. But, you know, in order to bring his body down, there's really quite a danger to the recovery team, the rescue team. Just from the sheer numbers of little cliffs they've got to go over and carrying the stretcher down through some really miserable talus and big rocks and trees and other kinds of junk. And they said, okay, we will lift him out of there. So they go in. They do a hover check, a power check, above the site, you know, maybe 500 or 600 feet up. Then they lower down onto the top of this victim, who is now in a stretcher. He's in a body bag, actually. He's in a stretcher. And he's in a spot where there's no trees around, and it's pretty safe to pick him up. And it amounts to about a 30-foot hoist. And we use Lemoore largely because they had a 900-pound cable hoist on their helicopter.
Okay.
So they could lower us down, they could raise people up, kinds of stuff. Again, stuff that we sort of take for granted in many ways anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But in those days, none of the civilian ships had those The Highway Patrol, the California Highway Patrol, did not yet.
And I'm gonna jump in here for a minute for a point of clarification. You mentioned the park had its own ship. Is that right?
Well, yes, the park had a ship for the summer. It was a fire.
Okay, got it. Thank you.
It did not belong to the Park Service. It was on contract.
Okay.
And was there maybe 4 months of the year.
Okay.
And they were housed out at Crane Flat Lookout. There was a hella base there, a small one. So, the park and the rangers flew and looked at this scene, assessed it. There was nothing they could actually do from the air.
Right, because they didn't have a cable hoist.
No, and they couldn't land. Either.
Right.
There was no decent place to land.
Right.
So that's Navy was assisting us.
Mm-hmm.
And there was always some minor conflict between, the civilians and the military in this sense that, the civilians often thought that the military was taking an unfair advantage of the money that could be made by them flying these kinds of missions. But, of course, they recognized also that they did not have a hoist.
Right.
And we could justify using them because of the hoist. But they were also a larger platform. We could get more people in a Huey.
And I'm also going to seek another little point of clarification. Basically, your job that day was the SAR shift supervisor. Would that be?
Not the shift. No, I was for the whole, 24 hours.
24 hours, okay.
A week or two at a time.
But your job is to kind of coordinate all these different things that might happen throughout the park. You weren't on scene. You weren't there working with that. You sort of knew what was going on, but kind of the overseer of many different operations that day.
Well, yeah, but I think that's a little bit of a stretch in the sense that the rangers, there was a lot of autonomy by the rangers.
Okay.
And if the particular rangers on duty, which most of my peers were very capable of taking care of any of this on their own.
Okay.
They would just do this stuff and get them moving,
Right.
Now, I might bless it. I might help oversee it, but mm-hmm. I really wasn't there to do anything. But on this particular incident, I was also the, because of the training that I mentioned with this park medic, I oversaw the training stuff for the rangers as well. So we were actually having Bureau of Narcotics and Drug, Dangerous Drugs, BNDD, which is the predecessor of the Drug Enforcement Agency, or DEA. They came into the park, and they were putting on a several-day training on drugs.
Okay.
So, some of my rangers, some of our rangers are in that room, in the auditorium. I'm coordinating it. And, this body recovery is in good hands. They don't need me.
Right.
I mean, to some degree, some of those guys had a lot more expertise than I did, probably.
Mm-hmm.
So, I might hear some stuff on the radio, but I'm basically ignoring what's going on out there.
Okay.
So they do this hover hoist 30 feet up. And just as the stretcher gets into the side door, this Huey, HH1N Huey, Vietnam era helicopter, has two doors, one on either side of the cabin. Just as the stretcher gets into the opening, one of the engines quits. Now, Tom Stout, Lieutenant Tom Stout, S-T-O-U-T, is the pilot, and he, they got trouble. They turn around, and they end up trying to get back down to the valley, or to the floor. They're in the valley, but up to the floor of the big meadow,
mm-hmm.
which isn't too far away horizontally. It's about 500 or 600 feet vertically, but it's probably not more than half a mile horizontally.
Right.
But they end up corkscrewing into the pine trees and the scrub oak. And they go in on one of their door on one side, and the crew chief in the back had enough presence of mind to slam one of these doors closed. As it turns out, it's the only door. One door was locked open, and one door was, you could close it. And I, you know, I'm sure that he knew which is which, but he closed whatever he could as quickly as he could. And as luck would have it, that helicopter went in on that side. So you would have, if that door had not been slammed shut, you know, the door is like, what, 5 feet wide or something, right, like that. If that door had not been slammed shut, and the helicopter, which, it, you know, went in on that side, had that door been open, everybody would have been shish kebabbed.
Right. By the trees.
Yep. And they weren't tall pine trees, but they were scrub oaks and mm-hmm. junky stuff. So all of a sudden, that helicopter is burning. And that entire helicopter is now burnt up. It's burning. I mean, it's not, at that point, it's not burning. Or not burnt. But it's on fire, and ultimately, everything is melted down to just pieces of metal. The body has been cremated. No one, I think one of the crewmen maybe had a hairline fracture in an arm or a leg, and fairly minimal in many ways. But it could have been super worse, but it was not. And, you know, the next couple of days, of course, there were admirals and, you know, big wigs coming into the park to see why they're, at that point, like $1.5 million helicopter had crashed and burned.
Right.
The pilot was never any issue with the pilot. It wasn't pilot error or anything like that. It was an engine failure.
Yeah.
And to this day, and I think this is pretty close to being true, apparently, as I've heard the story, that particular engine had some issues in the civilian world as well.
Hey.
And to this day, the Park Service has never seen a report as to why that engine went out.
Oh, interesting.
Huh. And because of, you know, potential lawsuits and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, but the Navy, probably 40 times a year, would be in the park helping us out.
Okay.
And I can't say enough nice things about their professionalism and their courtesy and their willingness to help.
Nice.
And their interest in what we were doing. And, you know, we made some lifelong kinds of relationships over the years. And then the Navy ended up doing away with that program somewhere in the 90s, if I'm not mistaken. But then they resurrected it about 8 or 10 years later.
Huh.
So I think it's back in operation. But in the interim, the California Highway Patrol now has hoist-equipped larger helicopters.
Okay.
That the park relies on a fair amount. And then the park now has a helicopter. You know, it's not theirs. It's just like, you know, it's always been a fire helicopter.
Okay.
But they do the long hauls. They do the heli-repelling programs. They do the short hauls, you know, putting rangers in on these cliffs.
Right.
Which is, you talk about incredibly...
Yeah.
Brave and, you know, talented.
Dangerous.
That whole operation, you know, which one of my, this last book I wrote basically, you know, speaks to that quite a bit. And it's just evolved over time. It's like the EMS program. And, you know, of course, they couple that now with the helicopter and the short haul kinds of programs.
Mm-hmm.
So it's evolved, and I think that, you know, the general public, the people who are either witness or recipients of this talent should be terribly grateful and terribly appreciative and terribly impressed and all that stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, hey, I don't know how I got to this spot. You were asking about, I guess, Lamar stories.
Yes.
And, that was one.
Okay. That's good. That's we were I'd asked you about John Chu, and you'd mentioned that he had started up this sort of helicopter program or was very instrumental in the Department of Transportation looking at EMS, Flight for Life stuff. And so that got us off into Lemoore, and I was like, well, then let's go for that.
Okay.
Yeah. Anything else you remember about John?
Well, John and I have actually been in conversations here over the last couple of years. He sent me his flight suit a couple months ago, because I told him that I wanted to put on paper some of this EMS history, this early Park Service EMS history.
Okay.
And so he and I have pretty lackadaisically and without any real great precision have been compiling some information between the two of us on some of this history. We each try to jiggle each other's memory. And, but he, you know, he still lives, as I say, in Annapolis, but he's sort of out of the business. I think for a long time, he actually ran a consulting company for, like a one-man consulting business where he would assist these Flight for Life kinds of programs.
Uh-huh.
Because he still knew the players, he still knew the policies, he probably wrote half of them, if not more. But I think even that, you know, I'm 77, so he's probably 75, 74, perhaps in there. And so, you know, he's perfectly happy to go out and kill unsuspecting ducks with his shotgun. I guess I don't know what else to say really about John.
Okay.
I think that does bring up something I need to ask him about, which is a little bit of his early history, so I can
good.
Put it in, you know, in one spot for him.
Good. Okay. That sounds good. I was also wondering about not so much the amazing events like, you know, Navy helicopter going down, but about the day-to-day, day-in, day-out things that were happening in the valley that you remember. Or during the 10 years you were there, housing or shopping or school, you know, just day-to-day life.
So there was a K-6 grade school and in the valley.
Okay.
And I think depending on the year, sometimes it was like up to eighth grade. And it had been in the park since the late 1890s, probably at least. So when I was there in the valley, there was a fair number of kids in the school, probably 50 or 60 at least.
Okay.
And all, you know, different grades, of course. And then the kids from high school had to go to Mariposa, which was roughly about a 50-mile drive, and down along the Merced River Valley, the canyon. Which in wintertime is actually quite hazardous. It can be. You've got snowstorms and ice storms and ice, and the road's one lane wide each way, and you're right alongside the water's edge. So if I were a parent of a high school kid, you know, I'd be a little nervous about my kids going up and down that canyon every day, twice a day. So some parents actually sent their kids off to a boarding school in Salt Lake City, or not Salt Lake, but in Utah.
To the Wasatch?
Yeah, the Wasatch Academy.
Okay.
And Wasatch was really quite a going concern in those days. Enough so that I wanted to to document it a little bit. I talked to them about some of their history.
Nice.
And have got some of it written down someplace. But, you know, a lot of the parents ended up sending their kids. And that wasn't just from Yosemite. It was from other parks as well.
That's right.
And I don't know how many percent, what the percentage would have been of their students were Park Service brats, but a lot of them were. So, you know, there was this little school in the valley, and, of course, the rangers and the other staff in the park would provide various programs, and, you know, they'd come over and see the fire truck kinds of stuff. And so we did a lot of that.
Okay.
During my era, there was not a, what am I looking for? There wasn't a place where you could send your preschool kids.
Like a kindergarten kind of thing?
Well, no, I mean, you would give your, put your kid there until it was time to pick
them up. Daycare.
Yeah, daycare. There you go. That's the right word. There wasn't a daycare facility there in the park while I was there, but there is now. And it's been there for a number of years, but it wasn't there in the 70s. So the television, we had a television station, but it wasn't, it was a repeater of some sort. And it was beamed right into the valley off of Glacier Point. And that had some controversy initially when it was being put in, as you might expect. But pretty quickly, everybody realized they wanted to see what was going on, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's, you know, pretty mediocre quality and maybe only a couple of channels at the most. That was there. The community was much closer in those days while I was there, and I'll leave. Regress or digress or move back in time for just a moment to say that, you know, about the time that we got there and prior, like the 40s and 50s and the 60s, the park was really quite formal in some, in, from a management standpoint. The women would have these socials where the women would be having their white gloves on. The superintendent's wife was the big wig. Was the one that would orchestrate some of these things, these gatherings. Of course, a lot of women were working at this point, but a lot of women were not. And then when I first got there in 71, they were sort of coming out of that era, but you could not have a pet. You could have, I think, goldfishes, and you could have birds. But you couldn't have cats, you couldn't have dogs, and whatever other pets there are. And that sort of got relaxed while I was there as well. And, you know, there was a lot of, you know, people saying, well, I know that Mrs. Jones down the street's got a cat, but she doesn't claim it. And, you know, people were sort of tattling on each other.
Hmm.
Sort of small town politics in some ways.
Okay.
But collectively, it was everybody was willing to help each other and would jump in and do stuff for everybody else. And, it was very good from that standpoint. Parents didn't have to worry about where the heck their kids were.
Right.
They could sort of let them roam around, at least up until the, you know, the hippie era sort of came into being. And then I think it became a little more guarded, but, you know, it was a safe environment. The kids had a great childhood. You got a small river running through the middle of your backyard, if you will, and you got cliffs and places to hide and play and build forts and stuff.
Yep.
So I know that you could go today. I bet I could walk into the Yosemite Valley and within not too many minutes find some old tree fort that somebody had built in the 1960s that has been abandoned and never been seen since, practically.
Mm.
So it was a pretty comfortable environment, but we had the clinic, and that was good. But if you needed, you know, more serious stuff, you had to go outside the park as well.
Oh, I wanted to ask you as well, Butch, about the magistrate. Who was the magistrate?
So, Judge Ottonello.
How do you spell that?
O-T-O-N-E-L-L-O. And I think it's only one T, but I could be mistaken. It could be two. Was there, you know, if you bear with me for just 1 second, I could probably, I can't do two things at one time, Tom. I can't
no worries. Talk, you take your time.
I can't talk and then pull up this one document that will give me everything you ever want to know about Judge Ottonello. Let's see. I'm still here. I'm just actually scrolling through.
That's fine.
Oh, come on, Barry. Where are you? Well, I don't know that I want to waste any more of your time. You know, I've got the dates that he was in the park and that sort of thing, but he'd been there for a long time.
Okay.
His some of his family had grown up there, and he was pretty strict, actually. I think fair, but I also think he was kind of strict, and I don't know that he necessarily could quite understand this new generation. You know, the sort of the long hair hippie kinds of people that he was seeing more and more of. You know, there were times in the park, Tom, I'm not having any real luck. If I weren't talking, I could probably find him quicker, but maybe just a second here.
No worries.
Well, hold on, actually. I have a whole pot full of information. Let's see. So, magistrate, let's see. Corners. I have everything you ever want to know about some of this stuff. Commissioners and guardians. Let's see. No, that's not it. Corner system. No. I guess you can cut off the middle anyway, can't you? Oh, here we go. It says magistrates. Okay, I'm in business here.
All right.
So,
what was his first name?
Well, just a second here, so I'll have to scroll down. There's a lot of magistrate stuff.
Okay.
You know, I can actually, okay. So, it's Gene, G-E-N-E, Joseph, J-O-S-E-P-H, O-T-T-E-N-E-L-L. So, there are two T's. Which I guess I should have known that. 1945 to 1975 in the park.
So 30 years.
Yeah.
So just paint the picture for us. This is a federal facility. It is almost a part, meaning not connected to California. It's in California, but it's.
Oh, it's a federal.
It's a federal facility,
yeah,
and
exactly.
In that federal facility is a federal magistrate. That follows federal law, not necessarily California law, but federal law.
That's right. And so this is what I've written a little bit. Of course, this is real dated now, but it says, as of 2011, Yosemite National Park is a federal magistrate judge who serves in a United States District Court. Magistrate judges are assigned duties by the district judges in the district in which they serve. Magistrate judges may preside over most phases of federal proceedings except for criminal felony trials.
Okay.
The specific duties of a magistrate judge vary from district to district, but the responsibilities always include handling matters that would otherwise be on the dockets of the district judges. Full-time magistrate judges serve for renewable terms of 8 years. Some federal district courts have part-time magistrate judges who serve for renewable terms of 4 years. And then this is all based on, you know, some laws that give this kind of authority. In this case, the U.S. Congress established the role of federal magistrate judges with the Federal Magistrates Act of 1968. And that replaces some other, you know, earlier laws.
Right.
But, you know, they go all the way back to into the
20s, but.
Yeah, the first magistrate was actually 1920.
Okay.
To 1922, Degnan, D-E-G-N-A-N, was appointed the first commissioner in July 1, 1920. until he resigned to go into private practice in 1922.
Okay.
But Degnan is also historically an important name in Yosemite Valley because of Degnan's Delicatessen.
Huh.
And I think that this, I mean, he's obviously a relative, but I don't necessarily think that was the original owner or anything, because Degnan's had been around back in the 1890s, if I'm not mistaken. So Aunt Nello was fair. He lived in the park every day, 5 days a week, pretty much, assuming there was somebody to be heard. He would have a hearing. Rangers would come in as a rule and give their side of the story. And generally, the person that was brought in before the judge was usually found guilty. He could only assess up to, in those days, it was a $500 fine or maybe 6 months in jail. So the park in 1973, the U.S. prison system, whatever it's here, the United States prison, whatever system is, built this jail in Yosemite Valley. It's, nobody knows about it. No one hardly knows it's there, but it was about a 22-person jail. And in the summertime in the early 70s, we often had more prisoners in jail than the city of Fresno did.
Wow.
I mean, it was that busy. And of course, we had a lot of misdemeanor kinds of low-level, petty theft, fights, drunkenness, drugs, kinds of stuff that would keep our jails full, So, but he would oversee this, and there are any number of occasions. I'm not so sure I have a photo. I wish I did. But there are times when we would have 20 prisoners shackled with their, with chains like a southern style chain gang, standing outside of this magistrate's court, which was then in the next to the, was it close to the visitor center, and one by one they would appear in front of the judge, and we had a ranger who served as a prosecutor, and he would attend to the logistics and the various documents that needed to be presented to the judge. And it was all done by the book. And, often these kids, mostly kids, would be fined something. Some of them could pay, some of them couldn't. Some would get hold of their families, that sort of thing. But, if they couldn't pay, then the judge might sentence them to a week in jail. And there was a number of... they weren't patrol rangers, but they were jail staff, that worked 24/7, taking care of the prisoners in this jail.
Hmm.
Again, you'd have to put yourself in the hippie era and some of the things that were taking place, and it was really quite an interesting process. In 1970, not long, let me think about this. About 1970, the park had a jail that had four cells in it, and maybe two people per cell. And there wasn't anybody babysitting these people all night.
Oh, wow.
Which obviously is a catastrophe about to happen, which fortunately it wasn't too bad, but somebody did passed somebody some matches, and they ended up sending a mattress on fire, and so the jail ended up being filled with smoke, and Dick Marks, in this case, bless his heart, and to his credit, abandoned that jail. We're not putting anybody in there now.
Hmm.
And So in the next 2 years, we ended up having this jail built. But in the interim, there were a couple things that would happen. One, we had a paddy wagon. We had a dedicated vehicle that had been converted. It was like a big sort of carry-all van that had seats in it. You know, certainly no seat belts, but you could be probably handcuffed to the seat in some fashion. I don't remember that. But we would go back and forth to the jail in Fresno, not in Fresno, but in Mariposa. You know, 50-minute hour drive down, hour drive back, then an hour drive back down at the end of the day, and an hour drive back. So there was a staff that would be part of the jail operation, but who would do this as well. And sometimes the rangers, whenever the jail would be short-handed, the rangers would be driving this paddy wagon back and forth up and down this river corridor. But the more interesting part of this is maybe not, depending on who you are, I suppose. But we in the visitor center, what is now the museum, really, but there was a room that was an internal room, had no windows to it. It was probably 12 by 12, perhaps, in size, and it was nothing but blocks, I mean, boulders. And this room had been built, and it had been painted white, and it was clean and everything. But if somebody were arrested at midnight or 2 in the morning, which is really, this is all very common in those days, they would end up being put into that room, and because there was no reason to spend 2 hours going down, 2 hours in the morning to bring this guy in front of the judge at 8 o'clock. So there were mattresses on the floor. They would be put into in the jumpsuits, orange jumpsuits. Their belongings would be put aside. I mean, there was actually a process for all this. We had a ranger who had been an old bartender at one time. His name was Uncle Fred. And, if I'm 30 years old at that time, then Uncle Fred is probably 55 or 60.
Okay.
And Uncle Fred would take these belongings, and he would be there. And there were numerous times when there could easily be 20 people crammed into this 12 by 12 holding facility.
Wow.
And, you know, I mean, again, by today's standards, it would be, you know, we'd be sued and we'd be all kinds of things.
Oh, yeah.
But I don't recall anybody ever being hurt or anything like that. But there's always that potential. So you've got 20 people crammed into this room. And rangers, including myself, probably half a dozen times that I did this, putting people into straitjackets. And, you know, I had no training. It was all OJT. You know, I'd watch somebody else do it. And because we'd have somebody high on acid, LSD, or in some ways, there's a California statute called 5150, CRS, California Revised Statutes 5150. And I think today, even today, the policeman in California might refer to a 5150, which is somebody who's crazy. Now there's a process today where people are assisted with these kinds of problems, but it wasn't as prevalent for us. It wasn't as convenient for us as it is today. And again, we just did what we had to do, which was take care of this issue. So this magistrate, in this case, Aunt Nell, to what I say, 1975, would sometimes he'd hear these people, in order to have them have somebody placed on a 72-hour psychiatric hold, we had to go through the U.S. Attorney's Office, I think, in Fresno. All of our bigger crimes, the felonies that were taking place, and there are a lot of them although they were felonies in the sense that it might have been drugs for sale, LSD, which was a felony, possession of LSD, although it could be reduced. These things could all be reduced down, which often they were. So we had a lot of felonies, but you had to run the felonies by assistant U.S. attorney in Fresno, and that's what this prosecutor, this ranger, in this case for the years I was there, his name was Scott Connelly, C-O-N-N-E-L-L-Y, and he just sort of grew into the job. It wasn't like he had any real legal training or anything. I mean, he went over time, of course, he went to different schools, training events, but you know, it wasn't like he was a master of law. Although I might mention very quickly, just if you're thinking about a little history here, because it has nothing to do with Grand Canyon, right? But there was a time when somebody could study underneath a lawyer and challenge the California bar, and you could become an attorney. You could do everything that, you know, all the other attorneys did that went to law school by training and having various steps to go through, but you did not have to go to law school. And one of the rangers, whose name just slipped my mind a moment ago, actually did this. And so when I first got to the park, that's who we would go to, is this man.
Hmm.
And, you know, he would help us out and interpret the law and be the intermediary between us and whatever else needed to be done. So, including working with Judge Antonello, my wife ended up being the judge's secretary.
Okay.
At the end of his time there, and then she ended up becoming the secretary for the incoming judge, whose name was let me think about this. Wait, actually, let me read it. It'll be Don Pitts, P-I-T-T-S. 1975 till 1994. And, Antonello, as well as Pitts and all the, not all the others, but some of these, most of these were all, had gone to law schools and were real lawyers.
Right.
Whereas I don't think that, that Degnan had been. I don't think he had been, I don't think he was a law school graduate at that time.
Did Judge Antonello ever make any decisions that you didn't agree with or you thought were inappropriate?
Well, I don't have any kind of an answer for you. It wasn't something I paid that much attention to.
Uh-huh.
You know, my job was to just sort of get people off the streets, if you will.
Right, right.
And I would appear in front of the judge and tell them my side of the story.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't have an answer. I'm sure that there are people who could give you that kind of information, but I'm not one of them. I do have a little minor story that has something to do with climbing. There's a very famous one of perhaps one of the world's best climbers, a guy by the name of Jim Bridwell,
mm-hmm.
B-R-I-D-W-E-L-L, Bridwell. Who was one of the early El Cap climbers and was really quite excellent. As I say, one of the best in the world. And the first time I ever met him was when you could still drive through Camp 4, which now is totally, you can't drive through it at all.
Mm.
But I was driving through it on a patrol just one afternoon. Didn't know Jim Bridwell from a hole in the wall. And I'm coming around the curve, because it was a loop camp spot, and one end was climbers. The climbers lived at one end, and just regular visitors sort of lived at the other end. So I'm going around the loop, and I see the climbers have tacked up a piece of cardboard with a target on it, with circles just by hand-driven or hand-drawn
mm-hmm.
circles, and they're throwing darts at it. Well, I go around the corner, and just as I'm coming around, Jim lets loose of this dart into this tree. Well, you know, in the great scheme of things, a woodpecker would have done more damage than that dart did, of course. But but it also seemed to me that Jim had done it despite me. You know, he saw the patrol car, he saw the marked vehicle coming around, and he threw this dart. Now, whether this is true or not, I don't know. But I ended up citing Jim. It turns out it's like a $25 citation. But he's got his entourage, and because he was so far up the totem pole, he's the king of the mountain, sort of literally, in a couple of different ways.
Mm-hmm.
His entourage that were, you know, they're all watching this dart game go on. You know, they got very upset that I gave him the citation. Well, he has to appear in court the next day, and so Judge Otnello fines him $25, and all of his everybody kicks in money and pays his fine for him, which is fine. I mean, I don't have any real heartaches about this.
Mm-hmm.
And but as a result, Jim and I get to be pretty good friends.
Cool.
We established this relationship, and I'm sure that we talked about this a little bit, but Jim was somebody that we as rangers and rescuers needed to help us out, because we didn't have the expertise, we didn't have the experience, and we needed people that could climb these big walls and, could do these sorts of things that we could not do.
Hey, Butch.
Yes.
We've been at this about an hour and 20 minutes.
Oh, geez.
And I have a lot of questions for you about climbing and Camp 4. So this Jim Bridwell story, I want to take that into a little further with where he becomes friends and he starts helping you out.
Okay.
So with that in mind, maybe this is a good place to wrap up this part 8.
Good.
And we will pick this up. For part 9. Does that sound like a plan?
Yeah, it's fine, man.
Okay, is there anything else you want to put in here with part 8 to wrap that up?
Oh, I'm sure that we'll come back to something that I don't remember now, Tom.
Okay. Well, thank you. With that, this will conclude part 8 of a oral history interview with Charles Butch Farabee. My name is Tom Martin, and Butch, thank you so very much.
Okay, talk to you later. Well, thank you. I'll stay on the line, I guess, actually.